this career will burn a lot of your life, and you need to work out if it's worth it. And if it's not, like Emilia Clarke says, do something else. But if that fire is lit inside you, and we will know that, there's kind of no choice.
Welcome to Filmmaking Framed, your video podcast uncovering the realities of filmmaking. I'm your host, Daniel Hughes.
And I'm your host, Tom Dexter. With us today is stuntwoman Lucy Johnson, who works across film, TV and video games. Lucy's credits include Gladiator 2, Batgirl and Vikings. Hello, Lucy.
Thanks for having me.
So, Lucy, could you, in your own words, explain the role of a stunt performer?
I think the common misconception about stunt people is that we're all adrenaline junkies. I think the nature of the job is, you know, you're doing cool things like jumping off buildings, setting yourselves on fire. I'd often say you are telling the action side of the story through the use of your body, often doing things that are quite dangerous to support the wider storytelling, essentially.
And what's the favourite stunt you've ever done?
That's so hard to answer. I think the one that I will remember for a long time was a stunt that was given to me by the very generous and supremely talented Pete Miles on The First Omen that's actually just come out. It's a prequel to the original Omen movie. So you have the iconic hanging scene. And I was given the chance essentially to recreate that moment. Being a big American prequel, we got the opportunity to make that even bigger. And I was lucky enough to get to jump off a building, hang myself, smash through a window, all whilst on fire. So that was pretty monumental. And yeah, one of the greatest experiences of my life. And that obviously, as with most filmmaking, came together thanks to a huge support team and wider cast and crew. But it was a very special moment in my career.
I'd love to ask you a bit about, you know, what your typical week might look like and the sort of balance between prepping a shoot and then actually performing the stunt. But I guess let's start off right off the bat with, you know, let's just explore the stunt of being caught on fire.
So stunts is a funny one. I think you basically have two types of stunt people on a film set. You sort of have the day players who come in and are hired to do a very specific skill. And you also have people who are there on the core team who get to be with the production from start to finish. And that is one of my favorite things to be able to do. And with that, the core team is essentially responsible for a lot of the prep. So I think this conception that we're all adrenaline junkies and we all just love to jump off things and do crazy stunts is negating the fact that there's a huge amount of prep and time that goes into making sure that stunts are safe. We are paid to take risks. However, you can still make a risk as safe as possible. And that would be the prep stage. So for something like setting on fire, I mean, you should already be trained to do a fire gag. Essentially what it involves is you get in several layers of usually freezing cold, gel soaked Nomex, which is sort of fireproof material that racing drivers wear. So ironically, when you're on fire, you're actually very cold. And if you feel heat, we often say if there's a pinch, then you're kind of already burnt and you need to deal with it pretty quickly. But so you're basically soaked in these freezing wet clothes, often in a race suit if it's a big burn. And then, I mean, essentially you're painted in petrol and glue and set on fire. So that process, I mean, for the Omen, for example, it was a very big stunt because of the combination of elements. So you would start with just the piece of being set on fire. And that might be a couple of days prep around burn itself and getting the gels ready, getting the accelerant ready, which is the petrol and glue essentially. But equally, you're also testing costumes. So you have to have sort of cotton things that are very, or can burn a long time essentially. So the core crew is prepping all of that. Now, I, as the stunt performer, am either part of that core crew overseeing that process, or I just turn up on the day and I do a burn test, for example, a costume test. You'll then add all the other elements in. I mean, that burn on the Omen, we spent 2 weeks prepping all of the wire gags and combining separately to that the fire elements. And then, yeah, after 2 weeks, it's, yeah, 20, 25 seconds of burn over half a day. But even the prep time for a burn on the day is about, you know, 30 to 40 minutes, mostly because you have to try and squeeze all the layers of harnesses and clothing around the costume and still make it work.
And how did they put you out? They roll you, or that sounds really stupid.
They literally extinguish you. So usually what will happen is someone will drop to the floor, as you'll see a lot in movies, on fire. And usually that's the signal to go put me out. So when I was jumping off the building, we had two signals. One was to make a T-shape. So if I made a T-shape at any point, because I was meant to be hanging myself, so therefore that's not the obvious position to be putting yourself in, that would be the extinguish me signal. And then when you hit the floor, you just go down, because then you're at least covering one half of your body to get rid of the oxygen.
Could you talk a bit about what stunt team, like the stunt department looks mm-hmm. like? So also there's the performers, which is what you do. There's stunt coordinators. What's the core team look like? What are the different roles and what are their responsibilities?
So it will vary from film to film and depend on budget. So on Batgirl, at our peak, we probably had a core team of, God, around 20 people. And then with the likes of The First Omen, it was a much smaller set of stunts we had to do. So our core team was probably 4-5 people strong. The stunt coordinator always sits at the top of that. And they are aptly put as one of my former bosses on Batgirl, Scott Rogers. He said, I take responsibility for everything that happens to this team, and fundamentally everything falls on me. So the responsibility starts and stops with the stunt coordinator. So they are the one who is overseeing the whole process of every stunt in the movie. And that can be everything from like a little push in an actor scene to something nuts like jumping off a building on fire. Underneath them, you often have an assistant coordinator who will be sort of stepping up into that coordination role. They will be running lots of the day-to-day, doing risk assessments, helping to sort of liaise with multiple departments. The beauty of stunts is that you're really working as part of the crew, but you also get to perform. So there's a lot of crew liaison that goes on. We work very closely with VFX, SFX, for reasons that I can go into later. So that would be the assistant. And then underneath that, you sort of have your performance team. You'll often have a lead stunt double for a big movie like Uncharted, for example. Tom Holland has two main stunt doubles. And then you'll have the wider stunt performance team, who will be your sort of background fighting. If there's a big bar scene, you know, you need a whole bunch of people losing their minds in the back of shot. And that would also be stunt people.
Amazing. And I guess I have a question around, presumably because there's so much prep that goes into a stunt, When the producer, the production department, and ADs are putting together a overall schedule for the project, how many days in a row can they have stunt without you not having enough time to prep?
It's a good question. Sometimes schedules change, which can make it difficult, but we would aim on a large scale production to be prepped for everything sort of weeks out. So Batgirl's a great example. We did 2 months of prep before filming even started. And as filming was going on, for the next 2 months, we were prepping for the second unit shoot, which was this massive night sequence over 2 weeks where, like, I mean, I think I was going on fire literally every single night and then being someone's fire safety, you know, a couple of hours later, and then doing something else, setting up a wire gag. So it becomes relentless. But we essentially, the way I described that 2 week shoot was, we prepped for 2 months to shoot for 2 weeks for probably 2 minutes of film. So like that's what you're working with, essentially.
And it's one where you can't afford not to do the prep for safety reasons and also for performance reasons.
Exactly. And I think sometimes schedules shift and you have to be reactive. And I think then that's where you have to have the trust that your stunt coordinator is able to liaise correctly with wider departments, with the director, on what is achievable. So often stunts are notoriously the last shot of the day. So if we're doing a night shoot from, I don't know, 8 p.m. till 8 a.m., you will have worked through the whole night and it'll get to 6 a.m. and someone will go, okay, this is your time to set up and go. And, you know, you're exhausted. And then if someone turns around and goes, hey, can we just change something? Let's, you know, move this setup, change the height of something on a wire gag. Your boss essentially will assess whether that's possible and then manage accordingly. I think Keir Beck talks about, he's a very successful stunt coordinator and director, talks about hiding behind a tree and having your thought process to yourself, then stepping out, engaging with everyone else. If they ask a question, take that time to go back behind like a wolf in the forest and then come out again to have the response. So you're not subjecting yourself to the pressure of a film set when tough decisions have to be made.
Yeah, so it sounds like a stunt performer has to be not only highly skilled in their performance skills, you know, whatever that, whether it's fight choreography or being set on fire and stuff, but you also have to be highly adaptable so that you, I guess, you have those skills so embedded in you that if something changes slightly, you can quickly adapt to it and do that safely still.
Yeah, I think the job is both. We often say that the job actually happens outside of shooting. You're constantly training, essentially, when you're not working. You're honing your skills, you're honing your body, you're making sure you're completely prepared for when someone gives you the call. And the off time is what will make you good in the on time. I think outside of the training, yeah, you need to have the skills that are for the job. And I think actors have this thing where, you know, someone goes, oh, can you horse ride? And you go, yeah, I can horse ride, and then get on a set. And it doesn't matter, essentially, because you're the leading actor. For us, if someone asks me if I can horse ride, I tell you exactly how much, to what level, and what I'm comfortable doing, because fundamentally I don't have that privilege when I step on the set. And the likelihood is something will change and I have to adapt. Adaptability is key. And training is useful, but you need to trust that on the day you can, you know, turn on a dime, you can be reactive and still do it safely. And like, sometimes when you're training, you have to bail out of moves or something goes wrong. And that for me actually is also really good training, because when something goes wrong on a film set, you have to be able to react quickly and make sure that you're safe and protect yourself and your team members. So that even when things go wrong in training, it's actually helping for that adaptation on a set.
It's definitely one of those roles where it doesn't serve to be dishonest with your skill set. Like if you're an AD and you're like, yeah, I know how to break down a script, and then you can't really, it's okay. But if you're like, yes, I can definitely throw myself across something, and you can't, you're putting yourself at risk. It's just not
people
worth
find
it.
Out pretty quickly yeah. as well. And like I've spoken to bosses in the past who go like, someone said they could do something, I gave them two shots, couldn't do it. Like, I need to find someone else who can, which is fair, because everyone's safety is on the line. Everyone's reputation is on the line. And, you know, you're only as good as the job you're on, is what I always think. And if you can't do that job, don't be there, because it will damage your reputation more than it will, you know, benefit it.
I was wondering if we could then maybe explore about that training process. So there are so many skills that you might be asked mm-hmm. to do. How do you, as a stunt performer, decide which skills to specialize in? And then as a second question, how do you balance keeping those skills all up to date?
with difficulty, I would say. So I think that there's a whole training process, and I think it depends what country, for starters, you would be doing your stunt training in. So America has a system of, they don't really have a specific guild or team or set of guidelines. So you would often join a stunt team, if you're lucky, at the bottom and work your way up, and through that learn and develop your skill set. The UK has a system set up by the British Stunt Register where you have essentially six skills that you need to hone and be assessed on before you can join the stunt register. Neither is correct, neither is wrong. Each have their pros and cons, essentially. Sometimes one will encourage more sort of safety around specific stunts, but others will give you sort of that on-set experience that's also crucial. You know, if I'm a really good gymnast, but I've only ever worked on a sprung floor, when someone goes, hey, we're in a concrete shed today, do you want to do your flips? And like, you have to adapt. It's a very different challenge. Usually your training would start from sort of what you know. So I would say most people go into stunts because they have some sort of affinity for something, be it, you know, you're a former gymnast or a martial artist, or you're a good driver. So you'd start there with your training, hone that, make sure that's sort of specific, adaptable and usable on set. So at the moment, there's a huge rise of tricking, and it has been for the past sort of 15, 20 years, which is sort of like parkour-y gymnastics is the best way to describe it. So it's all sort of side flips and funky things that look cool on a film. So as a gymnast, it's in my interest to also learn those skills, because they're more likely to be asked on set than, you know, a more specific gymnastics skill, for example. From there, you would then branch out to sort of wherever you feel your strengths are. So I'm a fencer by background. So sort of moving into a martial art that has similar stances. So I went into karate, makes sense. I was a gymnast as a kid. So moving into trampolining makes sense, possibly high diving. So you find things that sort of you have an affinity with and train them. I was lucky enough to start my career in Ireland, and their mindset, they have a register, which I'm also part of, but they also encourage the learning of those stunt specific skills, which we would usually say are fire, falling, fighting, wires, vehicles, animals. So like if you want to be set on fire on set, you can't walk onto a set and go, yeah, I've been set on fire. You have to have done the training, sort of work your way up from maybe a simple skin burn to a partial body burn to a full body burn. And you do all that training off your own bat, off your own money, off your own time, in the hope that the opportunity will arise that you get to use those skills.
So it's kind of like your own business, and you're investing in mm-hmm. your own training. So you're paying, you know, the earnings you might get on a film, you know, taking some of those earnings and investing those into a skill so you can earn more money.
Essentially, yes. And I would say most of your life, like, you earn a lot of money, but the training costs a lot of money too. And even if, let's say, for example, I was training for the British Stunt Register, once I get on, I then need to hone the skills of wire, fire, falling, vehicles, if I haven't done the driving training or motorbike training, for example. So your learning kind of never stops. And martial arts fall in and out of style. Fight styles fall in and out of style. So at the moment, we've got this sort of very fast, dynamic, maybe sort of Hong Kong style martial arts, which is very prevalent and popular in film. So it's in my interest to make sure I can fight in that style. That sort of, the Gangs of London brought about the rise of that sort of gritty fight, you know, just directors go like, throw a punch, welly him, you know, whatever it is. And like, you have to create a dance out of that and do it safely, but make it look really gnarly. So you'll practice sort of, you know, how to throw a punch sort of that looks out of control, but it's entirely in control, for example. So you're always on a treadmill of training, spending money, and then you hope you can make the money, spend the money. But it usually pays you back in dividends, I would say.
Would you gear your training towards a specific job? Like, how much notice do you get between getting booked and in working on something?
Oh, gosh. So I've had jobs that I've waited a year and a half for to turn up. Some that have never turned up. I have been called, I think my favorite example is Batgirl. I was due to be working a month on a full-time production in Scotland, and I was given a week's notice that it was cancelled. And, you know, your world falls apart. You're like, oh, what am I going to do? And literally the day after, I got a call from a former colleague of mine. He went, can you send me a reel putting you up for Batgirl? And a day later, I drove 8 hours to Glasgow and I was working for 5 months. So that sort of job, you have to trust you've done enough training. And, you know, for example, that job at Batgirl, her martial arts style was sort of very kicky, taekwondo-y. So I could apply my karate skills. The villain had 2 flamethrowers. Perfect. I've done a lot of fire. So you also get lucky with your skill set, but coordinators will be asking for the skill set. So like Vikings, for example, my first job, my sword fighting teacher at drama school was called up and they went, I want a shit hot fighter who's blonde and 5'4". And he went, I've got a shit hot fighter who's blonde. And I turn up and I'm 5'7" and I impress them and they go, okay, just bend your knees when you meet the producers. We'll we'll make it work. So like often you're hired on your skill set already. America is a very different system. America, you are often a specialist in a couple of things, whether it's fighting, whether it's cars, and your entire career is built on that single skill. The UK industry is a bit different insofar as we're kind of master of all trades.
Why do you think that difference exists?
Every country has a slightly different system that has just emerged from probably the culture and the industry. So America was at one time, I don't know if it still is today, arguably, yes, I would say, is one of the biggest film industries in the world. There was a meteoric rise in filmmaking over there, which then will have required a meteoric rise of stunt performers. So let's say you suddenly need 100 people, you're going to get enough American go-getters, as the culture is out there, who go, yeah, I can do that. Yeah, I can do that. Yeah, you can teach me that in a day. And they might have an affinity for something and they can apply their knowledge. And then you create a stunt system of like go-getters. And, you know, there's rumors in America of people sort of muscling their way onto film sets to give their CV to a stunt coordinator. And that's what's respected over there, where the British system's very like, we have sets of rules that you must follow and tick boxes to get there, because that's a much more British approach. The Australians have this great system where you sort of do a series of stunt training that's highly relevant to being on a film set, working with animals, working with vehicles, having sort of a fight skill. And then you also get two recommendations from existing coordinators. And every system has its ups and downs, but it is, I think, just the nature of the beast. And the UK is now having this huge rise in filmmaking. I mean, arguably, it's been a bit of a slow year so far. And it will be interesting to see how the market adapts to that. And, you know, we're close to Europe, so can we import talent from there is going to probably be one of the big questions.
I'm really curious. So obviously with the mega boom that we had a few years ago, mm-hmm. particularly in 2022, you were seeing people getting stepped up extremely quickly. Mm-hmm. And that kind of, like, I've been on jobs where it was like four HODs were doing it for the first time,
yeah.
for example. Was stunts kind of insulated but from that by the British system of you need to be in the guild and you need to do, or did you guys experience the same kind of...
There was, when there is a feast, the doors have to open for more stunt performers. I've come from a slightly odd background by the fact that I'm on the Irish register and I've honed the correct stunt skills, but I'm not on the British stunt register, although I am training for it because my whole goal is like, don't play politics, just do the job. So I had a big rise in 2022 because there was a need for people. I was hired by an American coordinator who valued my skill set above everything else. And so I go, yes, the doors did open and the box ticking lost its power. But because stunts is so specific, you kind of still need to hire talent who can do the job. And often accidents happen when that isn't the case.
And stunts going wrong has an impact that almost no other part of the industry going wrong has. Mm-hmm. So if I don't find the right location, okay, that impacts the scene. Or if the AD doesn't manage it, we overrun and it's overtime or we have to reschedule whatever. Whereas when a stunt goes wrong, people's lives can change. Mm-hmm. People's lives can be lost. So it makes sense that that impetus that you have to train, you have to be ready and you have to take that responsibility before going to a step up, because you said earlier, if you're not ready for a job, you're not doing yourself a favor being there, because it sounds strange to say, but you guys are just playing with bigger stakes than the rest of us.
Yeah, we're literally playing with fire. Often. Yeah. And I think often the errors that have happened that have then caused accidents to happen on set in the recent years, and this might be quite a broad generalization, and forgive me if that's the case, I've seemed to have seen that happening either where there is a lack of correct training or someone is being put in a position under pressure to deliver where they might have a specific skill set but not a stunt skill set. So I might be really good at, I don't know, driving a motorbike but not necessarily doing stunts on that motorbike. Or you see it where, and I think the biggest thing and the most solvable thing that you can see is the lack of communication. And that is communication between departments. That is the stunt coordinator taking the time to have that chat with the director about what's going on, making sure the AD is involved. And film is very dynamic and very energetic. And I think that's a reason we're all part of it. And decisions can get made very quickly. And if people aren't kept up to date with those decisions, that's often where accidents might happen. And that's very solvable if we all just
share that information.
Communicate, and easy for me to say at the bottom of the rung, who's not having to deal with, you know, a big shot director in the moment. But usually it's communication that breaks down that causes accidents.
And I'm curious, which are the departments that have the greatest flow of communication with stunts?
We're really lucky because we get to work across the board. So my favourite thing about being on a core crew is that you get to really build relationships with everyone. You're so much a part of the crew. I mean, the first Owen was a great example. Everyone from sort of the producers you're, you know, chatting with all the way to sort of crowd wranglers and costume and makeup. You kind of have to be allies with all of them and friends with all of them. And I make it my mission if I'm on a core crew to make sure that I have a relationship with someone from every department, because there will come the day, and I always call it picking the battles, where you're going to have to pick a battle. And if you push or ask too many favors before that moment, someone might not turn around and do you a favor. So like my favorite example is on The Omen. Like I was wearing this a wig for months on end, your hair's getting wet, pulled around, everything's itchy, it's not particularly pleasant, you're getting splattered in blood, you've got spiders crawling all over your face, you're getting stabbed, you're like leaking bodily fluids day after day after day after day. And you just hold your tongue, you stay professional, and the day turns or comes around when I have to go to the head of hair and I essentially go, look, I know you've got this lovely wig for this character who's jumping off a building on fire, but we need you to sew in some real hair wefts into a fire hood because that's going to keep me safe. And that needs to happen in the next couple of days. And I need three of them. And like, that's the battle I care about. You know, my battle with costume on that job was knowing that when I needed the skirt taken up at the front so I could take the step off the balcony without worrying about tripping or anything because you're on fire. That's my battle I care about. Everything else doesn't matter. If you need me in a costume that doesn't, you know, quite fit or is, I don't know, hasn't been washed or like, it's rarely that, to be fair. You just hold your tongue because a decision will be made that will actually affect you doing your job properly. And that's the one that matters. So like you truly interact with everyone. ADs, we're often on set, on core crew, sort of, you know, supporting a coordinator, monitoring a situation, running to get pads. And you're very close with VFX and SFX just by the nature of the job. So like on Batgirl, the flamethrowers were created by the SFX team. But obviously we're the ones being set on fire by the flamethrowers. So you have to have that conversation and explore that process together. VFX is interesting in the sense that for now, stunts and VFX are very close friends because if you want to animate someone on fire, you probably need to set me on fire first to create, you know, the base layer of that. And then you add to it is usually how you create the best effect. At some point, there will be enough database probably of fire that I don't need to go on fire anymore. And that might be when we're not so friendly anymore. But for now, I go, there's a huge affinity with that. And VFX at a detailed level is highly expensive. So until that changes, we will be allies.
I was wondering if we could just go back a little bit on the training side of things. Are there certificates that you get to prove that you have skills, or is it all based on you having done it on a previous job and people know you can do it?
It depends on the skill. So something like a rigging course, I've gone and done Kirbex rigging courses, which I would highly recommend if you're interested in wire work, just from understanding systems that are hauling you around sets. You get a certificate for that. You get certificates for certain BSR skills. A lot of it is you earning the right to be on the set through previous work. And that's where your showreel becomes very important. So I got the burn on the first Omen because I was able to have footage of me from Batgirl doing some crazy burns on moving vehicles and nut stuff. And unfortunately, none of that can be released to the world thanks to the whole production being put on the shelf. However, if you have some sort of base footage or you've got proof that you've done that that can be shown to someone confidentially, then you go, hey, look, you need someone to do a complex burn. I've done a complex burn already, and that earns you the job. I mean, so much of this industry is based on recommendations and your reputation and on people giving you a shot, essentially. And I owe my career to a lot of people giving me shots. And I love the idea that you're an overnight sensation or like, you know, you just need that one break. And I'm like, I don't think you need one break. I think you need like five or six solid breaks in your career. And people need to consistently give them to you and consistently back you for you to be able to have this career. It's not one magic moment that we're all hoping for. People always need to take a chance on you. And that's where I'm like, always be kind to people on the way up. Always be generous with your time. Always be professional. Always be the nicest, most hardworking person in the room because you never know where people are going to go and you never know who's going to recommend you for a job.
And who has given you your breaks?
So many people. First and foremost, I guess, Richard Ryan on Vikings, who hired me despite being 3 inches too tall. And we bonded over our love of fencing. I was an international fencer at the time. So he introduced me to this world. So I will always be grateful to him. I think Scott Rogers, the stunt coordinator and second unit director of Batgirl, truly has influenced my career in unimaginable ways. He taught me the value of working hard consistently, even when you think no one's watching, showing up no matter what is happening. and delivering your best. And he took chances he gave me, also through, you know, again, I'd had my reel, I'd proven my worth over a series of months and we'd built up to things, but he gave me a lot of my sort of big feature film stunts, my first vehicle fall, crazy burns on top of vehicles, amazing wire work. He got me in the bat suit to double Batgirl on a night when no one else was available, but I'd spent months rehearsing the stunts. See, to a certain extent, like, you earn your position, but he took that chance on me and he has irrevocably changed my career and has been a sort of mentor ever since on, you know, getting through the hard times, on training right, on focusing on what matters. And then I guess Pete Miles is the other coordinator who has transformed my career. He gave me that burn on the first Omen. He got me to double the lead on top of that. Incredibly generous man who has backed me, recommended me, supported me, advised me on everything from training for the British Stunt Register to approaching difficult stunts, managing departments and set politics. I've been blessed to have such incredible mentors. And yeah, I will owe my career to them.
And to the work that you've put in, and to the work that you've put in not on set.
Yeah, and I think my greatest advice to anyone, regardless of what part of a film set they want to be on or in, is that you have to keep showing up for yourself every day. And no, I think the industry, sadly, it doesn't dislike you and it doesn't like you. It is just indifferent to you. And so you have to be backing yourself no matter what. And by God, there's going to be some hard days. But you have to keep turning up for yourself. And I used to just try and do one thing for my job every day. If it's going to training, if it's getting a sports massage, if it's getting to bed early, if it's writing to a couple of people, if it's, you know, making a short film, whatever that is, you just have to keep showing up for yourself. And so, yeah, at the end of the day, when you get on set, it's you and you have to do the job and you have to prove your worth. But you still need someone to open that door for you.
I think it's interesting what you said about there not being just one job as your big break. And it's interesting, I think it applies to other roles as well, but definitely to performers. Is I always know when I'm looking at a CV, is if someone's worked with someone twice,
mm-hmm.
is usually the sign that there was a really good working relationship, that the person worked really hard, rather than that you've got one credit that was really great, but then you've not got any others. It could be, you know, a sign that actually they weren't that great. Because you can get in and get that opportunity, but you need to then prove yourself so that you get the second opportunity and the third opportunity. Then you go, okay, this person's great, we'll give them a shot.
And that's where I think core crew is amazing as well, to be able to put on your CV, in the sense that, like, I've worked with a coordinator for, I don't know, 3 to 5 to 8 months. And throughout all of that, we work well together. We navigated an entire film or TV series and we made the magic happen. And that's proof that, like, you're nice to work with. You can do your job, you can adapt and you can deliver.
I was wondering, we've covered so much already, and I know basically my question is what are common misconceptions? And I know the big one you started with was that you're not all just adrenaline junkies, which might be a misconception that the public has. Are there any misconceptions that the crew has about what stunts are doing?
how do I say this nicely? I think there's probably a misconception around ego, but I think that's not just in stunts, to be fair. I think a lot of film is a really fun job. There's a lot of money to be made. It's a really creative space where everyone has opinions. And I think there is often a conception just amongst departments that, like, what we're doing is the most important thing, or what we're doing is, like, crucial. And actually the reality is everything is crucial to the making of a movie. Like, film is a team sport, without a doubt, from start to finish. From, you know, the ADs picking up a coffee for you all the way down to, you know, the director choosing that final cut. It's everyone involved matters. So, but I think the misconception would be like, oh, we're stuntmen, we're tough, you know, we do all the cool things. And like, I guess like that just comes from communicating or dealing with the right people. And I also go, like, people will make their own way in this job. And if your way is walking in and having a swagger, good for you. The way I've always earned it is, I'm like, I'm happy to be the wallflower until you need me. And then I'm going to rise and then I'll deliver my job and I'll walk away. And I think, you know, stunts in general is highly unrepresented in, you know, awards ceremonies. Very few actors will, you know, shout out to their stunt doubles, and like massive shout out to Ryan Gosling at the moment for really representing on the Fall Guy. But yeah, I think just in general, being humble, doing your job is kind of what can wash that away, but also like rising and showing your worth, because people will also forget you. So I guess that is what probably creates a system of people walking in with look at me attitude, maybe. I don't know.
I wonder if we could explore, as a performer, what maybe you notice are the differences between a stunt performer, maybe lead cast, supporting cast, and then supporting artists. I know you've got some really great differences between those.
Yeah, I'm more than happy to share. I think the beauty of stunts, like I've said, is that you get to work as part of the crew. The flip side is you also get to perform, and you get to be on the camera as well. And like, what a privilege to be able to do all of that. And then within that, you also get to, you know, work as soldier number 48, at, you know, the back of the shot, all the way to doubling the leading actor or actress. And so like, it's a huge privilege. And I think what's interesting is, in general, actors are treated with reverence on set, and in some ways rightfully so, because when we say 3-2-1 action, they're the person who has to deliver and the job has to get done. But I also think it's important to remember that for that job to get done in that moment, there is a massive pyramid that has been built behind you of people who are rising you up to that moment. And I think as a sort of supporting actress or a leading actress's stunt double, you get to share in that limelight and that reverence on the day. People go, oh, can I get you a coffee, can I help you out? And it's always remembering that that's not because you're special or talented, it's because someone's doing their job. And then, you know, you go all the way down to like being soldier 48 in the back, and like someone's throwing dirt in your face, and like you've got so much blood and fake blood on you, you don't even know what is real anymore. And you're just like slogging your guts out for 8 hours in like a costume that is entirely wet from your own sweat. And it's so grim. But I think the beauty is you see the full range. And like, you know, massive shout out to SAs who get very little, very little of the glory, and they have to rise every single day and bring that energy every single day. And like, you get that as a stunt person when you know you're with them shuffling through, getting your makeup done at 3 a.m. and someone's got a bottle of like fake dirt in your eyes, and you're just like, oh, this is great, you know. And I remember on Vikings we used to get like our eyeliner done at 4 a.m. and you're there like someone poking coal in your eye, just like, oh god, this is horrific. And then, you know, you go and double the lead, and they're, you know, they're there with all the different like makeup things and nice hand sanitizers, and it's just like, it's all a kind of funny hierarchy. And I think it just comes back to like, we are a team, and you should back every part of that team and respect every part of that team, because everyone's doing a job at the end of the day.
I guess because you're seeing that whole range from supporting artist or extra, as some people call them, all the way up to how the leads are treated, is it kind of demystifies that bit at the top, because mm-hmm. you're like, well, this is all performative, it's all, you know, that everyone's just being nice because it's a certain, you know, hierarchy, like you say. And that kind of keeps you more humble, because you're just like, no, it's just a role, that this is how they're treated, and it doesn't get into your ego or your head at all.
Yeah, well, again, everyone's a person, and I think being humble costs nothing. Being humble and being nice costs nothing, and it will always sort of stand you in good stead. I was lucky enough, I trained as an actor at drama school for 3 years, and my incredible acting teacher, Hilary Wood, who has been mentioned by many over the years, said something really important on this, and I will never forget it. And she said, when you're, you know, a leading actor and you're in your trailer and someone's puffing up your makeup and getting you avocado on toast and getting you hand warmers and gloves and checking you're okay and holding your phone and, you know, pampering you within an inch of your life, none of this is because you're special. None of this is because you're talented or pretty or any of the above. Someone is simply doing their job, and their job is the same as yours, which is to get the takes done in the shortest amount of time possible. They are only trying to make you comfortable so you have the space and freedom to do your job. And for me, when, you know, whether you're getting squirted in the face with dirt or it's getting painted on you, I try and remember that, of like, we're all just here to do our job. And, you know, even as a stunt double, particularly for a lead, you need to try and give that actor the space to deliver the performance. They are selling the character. They are selling the story. So it's important that you have the ability to entirely step back and blend into the wall and give them the space to do their job. And equally, you then have to be able to rise and also share parts of that character with them to deliver. And it's seeing that whole process, but also remembering that, like, no one's in the wrong, no one's in the right. Everyone's busy, everyone's tired, everyone's doing their job.
You had a really great story before we started recording about, you know, running through the woods with the leads at the front and then stunt performers and then the supporting artists. Mm. How are those sort of things coordinated? If obviously, you know, the director and the ADs are really focused on the leads and the stunt coordinator is really focused on the stunts, how do you put together a scene like that where, let's say, you've got a load of soldiers running through a forest? Mm-hmm.
That's 100% down to the incredible work of assistant directors and often the third ADs who've been there first, who will leave there last, who've signed in like 500 people and got them through hair and makeup. And the ADs will manage the crowd at the back. We'll have our own stunt AD and they'll work with the stunt coordinator and the assistant coordinator to get it all together. But I mean, like, you look at the supporting artists and like they will be on set first, basically. Sometimes stunts are there first because we are rehearsing action sequences. But then essentially an SA is standing around all day waiting for shots to be set up, and then they have to bring the fire, and then we sort of swagger on and bring the fire a little bit, and then the actor swaggers on last and brings even more fire. And like, so it's all basically run by everyone else, and you are just you're a very small cog in a massive system, essentially.
And how do you, in your mind, so you have to go from here to here, you know, you've got to maybe take a swing at the lead, mm-hmm. and then you've got to go over there, but you've also got all these other people around you, all of their own sequences. Do you find it's you just focus on what you need to deliver, or how do you balance being aware of what everyone else is up to at the same time?
I would say that's the secret of the job. And I'm very grateful for my acting training to have given me the awareness of performing, but also pretending and understanding marks, you know, camera frames, so you can really appreciate what's going on in the wider space. And like, I think at the end of the day, particularly with fighting, like, you need to look like you're really angry and you're going for it, but you should always be in control. So I treat it a little bit like a dance often, where like, you know your timing, you know who's meant to be running past you, you go and you deliver your piece of action and then you leave, and you just have to make it work. And you know, sometimes I mean I love it, this is also the beauty of being soldier number 48, for example, is like, chaos always ensues. And like, at some point you just have to be a chaos goblin. And like, I've had sort of things where someone will come up and like take your sword off you, and they go, yes, just, and they'll take your partner away because they'll go and be fighting a different actor, and like, you're stuck there on your own in the middle of frame, and someone's like, okay, 3, 2, 1, action, and you just have to be like, and like run at someone. And like, I've just like wrestled people to the ground, like, and everyone's got their choreographed routine and you just cause absolute havoc. Some people just take like arrow hits to try and get to the ground, or you know, you just try and make something happen. And I'm sure you've seen, like, in The Rage, you've got the amazing sort of, he's always moving when he's doing his before and after his fight sequences. And it's a little bit like that, where you're like, just keep moving, just keep alive. It's all going to look chaotic. And you look at, you know, Ridley Scott's Napoleon, and so much of those fight sequences are just carnage. But I'm like, that's realistic. Like, every time I've been in a fight sequence in a big army setup, you're standing there and you're like, oh, we'd all be dead. Like, every single one of us, like, this is such a stupid thing that humans did. I cannot believe that anyone thought this was sensible, because like, you would have no idea what's going on. And we literally have people telling us what's going on and we don't know what's going on.
One of my favorite battle sequences ever is in Battle of the Bastards. Jon Snow is in there and it's in the mud and it's just chaos. And there's a scene where two guys are fighting and Jon Snow then kills one of them and then he kills the other one. So you're like, he has, either they were both enemy soldiers that didn't realize, or he has definitely just killed one of his own guys, because no one has any idea who's fighting for who.
Oh, it's like, I've done sequences where, like, I think there was a scene in Vikings where the hero had to fight, you know, 8 or 10 people. And let's say there's 12 of us Vikings. So there's me and one other girl in the back of shot trying to keep the whole frame alive. And you're fighting like 20 enemies. And then like, all you can do is do like one hit kills and you're running through, you're sweating, that takes 8 minutes long. And then like, everyone's dead. So then you have to be like, guys, get up, someone get up. And like, everyone rises and you're like, oh my God, this is just, it's absolute carnage. And like, yeah, I look back on those days with the most fondness. The days where you're like covered in mud and blood and smoke and you can't see and you're having asthma attacks, because the camaraderie of the stunt team is built on those just mad days where you just have to keep going, keep rising, keep fighting. And like, God, I love it.
Is there an element of improvisation then to those sequences? Because yeah. They can't obviously orchestrate 450 people in a field all fighting at the same time and have individual choreography.
So we will often, prior to the filming, you'll basically find a partner or find a couple of partners and choreograph an 8-beat fight. And often we say, once you've done 8 beats, people can't recognize a pattern. And if you can add a turn into that 8-beat fight, then people really can't follow that pattern. So if I can create 8 moves with someone, that's usually what happens. And then SAs will often get basic training days on doing sort of high slashes, because the camera will read the high hits better than the low hits, or any sort of lateral stabs don't work as well as a slash. So, you learn all the tricks on the job. Like I remember early on in Vikings, it's like you always kill someone with a slash, because then VFX doesn't have to animate it, particularly if someone can die like quickly off frame, you know, out of frame. So you just find the tricks of like how to save people money.
So it's basically a load of small performances all happening in combination with little groups.
With a couple of chaos goblins running through. And then, like, you know, there's...
Technical term.
It's like the only way to describe it. And I used to hate it, because I think you, as a human, you're very self-conscious and you don't want to mess up anyone's plans. And particularly as, you know, if you've been in the situation where like you're fighting and someone ruins your routine, you get jarred for a moment. And so to be that person I used to hate, and now you go, this is brilliant. Like, we're just creating carnage. And actually that's probably the most realistic thing.
One element I'm really interested in is how, because you were talking about with slash and upper movement, is how fighting gets adapted to be more, to appear better on camera. And the one example I can give is there doesn't tend to be a lot of fights in kind of medieval, that kind of settings, with spears. Because if people are fighting with swords and axes, you can get more people into the frame. Whereas historically, we've obviously used pole arms, and you know the Greeks had the phalanx and so on. But then you'd have a bunch of people who are 12 foot apart who are just kind of spearing each other. So I was curious if you could talk about, in that vein, like we talk about with a high slash bit or attacking from above, being more cinematic and capturing better in other ways that, or if you talk about martial arts, like ways that moves are made less effective than they would actually be if you were really trying to fight someone, in order to make it easier to capture on screen.
Mm-hmm. I think it entirely depends on your fight coordinator, your fight choreographer, and what style you're going for. So I think the simple answer is a lot of fighting would look quite boring, particularly if you're thinking of sort of spears. I mean, most people, I'll be poking you through a shield and you'll be dead, and then I'll step over you, and like no one really wants to see that in a fight sequence. I've done quite a lot of work with spears. They are just harder to master, and if you've got limited time with an actor, you might choose not to give them a spear just out of like saving everyone a challenge. The style of fight kind of depends on what someone's prioritizing. So with this sort of like fast martial arts style that's becoming very prevalent in movies, they are favouring what looks cool, essentially. You know, let's add a couple of, you know, B twists into our fight. Let's do some fun, funky spins. And I'm a fencer by background, so I love when someone does a fencing sequence with a big turn in it, because I'm like, first rule of fencing is don't turn your back. And like, also, why would you turn your back on someone who's got like a pokey implement and is trying to stab you? But equally, like, it looks cool. So it depends if that's what you're going for. I started my career under Richard Ryan, who is... A huge fan of essentially storytelling, and he wants every single beat to have the story being told. So I should either be like trying to kill you or nearly dying, basically, in most of the fight. And the audience should be able to see what that is. Where I think often if you're moving too fast, for example, it looks cool, but like who's hitting who? Or you get sort of sword fights where the swords are meeting in the middle. Who's hitting who is sort of the question I like to come back to. So I sort of was trained on that. So for me, what I value is like seeing the story. And, you know, we learned at drama school, sort of two things happen when you run out of words to say in the script. You either have sex or you fight, right? Those actions should only those actions should only happen because I can't have a chat with you and resolve it. So we're not resolving it, which means the fight then needs to be an extension of that story. So yeah, you learn tricks of the trade. Like if I sort of slash rather than poke, there's a bigger arc, so everything looks more dramatic. You might use less spears, because also what you have is, if we're not fighting with two spears, it's spear on sword. You need to work with distance. So like, I would not attack you with a long range weapon at short range, but the sword fighter needs to get into short range for there to be any jeopardy. So it's not that it's not possible. And like, we've made some amazing fights over the years with exactly that, but you have to play with that jeopardy and understand that. So I don't know, I think you just learn tricks of the trade from everything, from like, you know, how a punch will sell, but also is so dependent on camera angle, how you're shooting a sequence. And again, like, some directors will, you know, want that sort of follow style where you do a single take and you're trying to track all the moves. You'll have someone who just wants to pan out or just get facial expressions. So like, our job often on the stunt team is like, we try and create something that tells the right story, that is true to the script, has fun weapons, cool moves, but also isn't kind of illogical. What I would say is, like, if you're really fighting, things often move so fast that you are reacting purely on instinct. That doesn't really work for film. So often we are slowing things down to present a moment to show something. So like, I remember when I started out as a fencer, my brain's like, wait, I just disengage off the line and stab you in the face and you're dead. And you're like, well, that's not a great fight. So I have to like go slightly too wide because I'm panicking, realize something's coming in. And then you're playing with every beat as if it's a big dance routine of storytelling, essentially.
There's a fascinating thing in the Star Wars lore where obviously you have the massive Star Wars fights where the lightsabers are flicking around all over the place. And then you've got the ones like between Obi-Wan Kenobi and Darth Maul, where it's a sort of more of a samurai one where they're sort of both judging each other and trying to work out who's going to make the mistake, and then one move and then it's over. And there's such a range there. And I know I sort of comment on it because there's such a controversy where some people love the lots of lightsabers, you know, flying around all over the place. And some people really like the psychology behind the fight of, you know, the Obi-Wan Kenobi fight.
You're talking about the one, the animated
it's
one.
In the animated show, yeah.
For anyone who's like, I don't remember that in Phantom Menace.
So, yeah,
he had two and they were waiting in two ways, yeah.
It's the animated show. But I guess that's what's interesting is that the director will make a call on
it's a stylistic choice
they go for.
And I trained in fencing in épée, which like the rule of my weapon in particular, not to go into too much detail, is if either of us hit, we get a point, which means that going in becomes very dangerous, which is a bit like real fighting. So I go, the reality of like, and I've had moments in my fencing career where like, it's so intense and you're like, you're making little moves and gestures and they're reading it and you're pulling out, you're trying to get a reaction. Then you know you can get that reaction and then you do it, but you stumble. And then like, I watch it back on video and it's just like bounce, 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 little like foot shuffle hit. And you're like, that's so not what I was living in my head. I was in this intense battle of wills and it's just like, it looks rubbish. So you go like, you can't have that a lot of the time on film because no one wants that.
And I trained foil for 9 years and I've also competed. And it's interesting because in épée, any part where you get hit counts the same. So they have these big ass guards and they're constantly trying to hit each other's wrists.
Oh, whereas, I love it. Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas in
flick.
In foil, it's just the kind of torso and back. With us, we have, if you take the other person's blade and then hit and they hit you, you get the point because you had advantage.
Yeah.
So you're right. It's completely different styles. And God, épée moves slow.
Until it doesn't, right? And then what I love is I was just working on a project where we were creating an épée fight and you go, okay, so one person is more skilled than the other, which means they can start playing with someone. So then the beauty of épée is we did like a wrist hit, flick to a knee hit, flick to a foot hit, back up into a running action, and suddenly it looks super dynamic. But in reality, like, it would have to be an Olympian versus an amateur for that to work, and obviously only one of the hits would land. So you always have to have creative license, otherwise fighting I think would either be boring or really messy. And like, I've had it where if you're doing a sort of sparring with someone and they just start going for you and like you don't know where anything is, and then you have to train that in by going, hit me more so I can like get more used to being in this environment. But fundamentally, like, you particularly like a street fight, you have no idea what's going on. It would just be chaotic. So you can either lean into that and make it super violent, or you can pull back from it and make it very specific.
A few years ago, I dabbled in giving historical European martial arts a go, or HEMA, which is basically it's supposed to represent actual sword fighting from back in the day. So it's slightly less fencing and more sword craft. And I'm by no means an expert, but it's fascinating. I guess what my question is that the community from that I'm still kind of in touch with, and there's a lot of historical experts that judge these fight sequences or the armor that people are wearing and making historical representations on them. When you're doing stunt performances, how conscious are you of people's basing it on historical facts?
I mean, sometimes you have that jokey thing of like, someone's going to YouTube this later and be like, actually, this is what this would have looked like. But I think it depends again on the coordinator in the production. So I was lucky enough last year to be invited to go and train out in America with 8711 and spent a couple of months out there learning about their fight processes. And I was teaching them fencing and other, and learning many martial arts back as a favor. But essentially how they operate is they go, let's dig into this style as much as we possibly can. And then we're going to either combine it with another style, or we're going to try and break that style and see how far we can push it where it still kind of looks like that style, let's say. And that's where the fun is, and that's the creative license. And I think, like, a bit like actors are told not to look at reviews, I think you go, like, you know what you're trying to deliver in a fight sequence. It might not be historically accurate, but then, like, I think a lot of historically accurate fights, like, people are going down in a couple of hits. It's just not interesting. And you look at the sort of John Wicks, and it's like these incredibly long, intensive fight sequences. And you're like, I mean, probably in reality, someone's just going to shoot him in the head and he'd be down after a couple of moves. Like, let's just be real. But that's not cool. That's not movie. And like, we're always stretching reality in film. We're always, you know, we get to tell the story that we want. So kind of, I go, that's the same with fighting, essentially.
Are there ever watching where you watch films back, and maybe not one that you've worked on, and you can kind of, does it ruin it for you having trained in stunts and worked as a stunt performer?
I've struggled to watch movies. Actually, it's become harder since I've started. My boyfriend and I are now trying to make short films, and particularly action short films, and sort of look at progressing into that. But me, once you understand the wider process of shooting, I think that ruins things more when you're like, framing's wrong or someone's crossed the line. I think the only time for me that, like, I'll always analyze stunts and fight sequences. I think my favorite moments are when like your friends turn up in a scene and it'll just be like a normal scene. You go, oh, I know what's going to go down. Like, we know where this scene is ending, because like, your friends only show up if shit's going to go down, basically. And like, there's only a couple of times where, like, if it's a very historically grounded show and then someone starts doing like martial arts fighting in Middle England in the Victorian era, I might go, come on, lads. But then I also go, hey, that's your call. Like, it's, I'm sort of here to go, like, you do you. And I think that the film industry in general has become so cookie cutter in its approach that anything we can do to break boundaries is probably more interesting, even if it doesn't work. So I would rather encourage people to be creative and have ideas and challenge the norm, as opposed to just going, let's make exactly the same movie that we've made 100 times and stick it in a cinema and people will turn up.
I wonder if we could now touch a bit about your journey into stunts. Mm-hmm. So you were a gymnast when you were young, you were a fencer, you did go to drama school at one point. Mm-hmm. When did you know you wanted to work in film and TV? And you know, your first job was Vikings, you said. Mm-hmm. So what was that transition? So if there's someone out there listening to this who's like, maybe they have an affinity for a skill, like you said, and they really want to get into it, what would that process be?
I think the ironic sentence is like, most people fall into stunts. Like, you don't choose it unless there's a sort of family angle that can already get you in. I go, the only people I know who want to be stunt people who kind of know it from a super young age are people whose parents, family, siblings are already in the industry. I trained as an actor. I started in musical theatre, of all things. Amazing. And whilst I was there, there was a stage combat course for the term, and I got really into that and loved it. Q went to drama school to do a 3-year acting course out in Ireland. And I think the first week I went, oh, I'll go and learn ballet. That will be really useful as an actor to, you know, posture, fitness, dance for musical theatre shows. And next to the ballet table was the fencing table. And I was like, I'm going to go and fence. So I ended up like joining this fencing club. And I had some affinity, thanks to the historical stage combat, learning rapier. And I am a fiercely competitive person, I think is the only thing you could say, insofar as, like, I think within the first session they'd put me on the development team. Within the first term they went, oh, there's a place on the university team if you fight hard enough. So I was like, we're getting on that university team. And by the end of that year they were like, oh, there's a place on the national Irish university team. And then, like, within 2 years I was on the international circuit fencing at World Cups, just like, we're doing this, we're 100% doing this. And all the time I was doing a 40-hour contact week at drama school, like an absolute nutcase. Absolutely loved it. For me, I just go learn as much and absorb as much as you can through life, because, you know, you never know when you're going to lose opportunities. But if anyone's giving you one, you should always take it. And it, to a certain extent, there was pushback at drama school that I was going to be too muscly to play leading women. But off the back of all of it, I essentially, my stage combat teacher got called up. And the stunt coordinator of Vikings went, I need a shit hot fighter who's blonde and who can come and do this. I did an audition tape. I got called for an audition. I got this bus down to the middle of nowhere in Wicklow, Ireland. Had like axes thrown at me and I was just had to learn on the job. And, you know, you're holding a shield when you're used to fencing with one hand. And I was grateful for my sort of gymnastics training and dance background that you can pick it up. And I got hired onto that job. And while I was learning this very complex fight sequence, boss was like, oh, Lucy, can you swim? And I'm like, yeah, I can swim. And you know, you're in actor mindset. I'm like, yeah, of course I can swim. And I think my first job as a stunt woman, they set the top of a swimming pool on fire. And they're like, so I just swim under the flame bars and then come out the other side. And you know, when you're like, oh, you need to be a strong swimmer, like strong, strong swimmer. And that was my first day, basically. And I just absolutely loved it. And I was very grateful to have some amazing training at drama school from the likes of Sue Mytham, Brian Burrows, who are these exceptional movement teachers and physical theatre practitioners, essentially. And they taught me the joy and the power of telling stories with your body. So although I trained as an actor, I could see the power immediately in being able to tell stories through stunts and through fighting. And so I found a love, and particularly thanks to Richard Ryan pushing this storytelling angle around his fight sequences, I realized there was a home for me in that space. And then I was like, oh, I was a gymnast as a kid and I can horse ride a little bit. And so sort of the world blossomed from there for me. And I think, you know, you kind of end up where you end up, but part of me goes, what's for you won't pass you. And where, like, acting's amazing and I love the storytelling and I love being able to inhabit all these different characters, and it's such a privilege to be able to do that and tell people stories. What you forget, particularly in film, is that you're often in your trailer prepping for a scene, then you go out and you deliver the scene and then you go back to your trailer. And where, like, stunts for me has become such a blessing is that you are there from start to finish. You are building the world. You're seeing how the world is lit. You're creating the story with the script, you're then performing that, and then you get to sort of help with the pack up and go home. But you are truly part of the system in a way that maybe as an actor you don't always get to be. And so I entirely fell into it and entirely fell in love with it. And I would say everyone's journey in stunts is different. I know people who are martial artists by background who go, oh, this might be interesting, cliff divers. The one that always upsets me is when people have a friend in stunts and they're like, oh, you make so much money, so I'm going to do that to make money. Because I go, it is a lot of money, but not at the cost of your body and your life if you can't do the job, for starters. And not when you then partition that money over months of not working, years of not working. If you expense all of your training back on that money you've earned, it's like, it's good money, but it's not that sort of amazing thing that you think it's going to be. And like, as someone who has come into this through storytelling, and I just adore the privilege of being able to tell stories and have serious conversations around like the most ridiculous things. We are so lucky to be able to be part of this when, like, you know, most people are accountants and doctors and, you know, God forbid, you know, in war zones, you know, like we just get to play for a living. And it is such a privilege to be there. And it just makes me sad if people don't realize that or they go for it for the wrong reasons.
I really love that. You basically made a decision as a young person that you wanted to tell stories and therefore you want to perform. and then you found your avenue.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's quite common to a lot of people in a lot of roles within film, is that so many people who do it love storytelling. Mm-hmm. And then they find where their affinity is. So it could be that they really love accounting as well. So they're a production accountant, or they work as a line producer, or they're really good at logistics. So they go into locations or unit managing. But that really, you know, it's not true for everyone, but there's so many people that choose storytelling and then see where that takes them. And I really love that about your story.
And like, I think we have the power to change the world in a different way through stories. And I know, I think Emilia Clarke said, if you can do anything else with your life than be an actor, do it, because it's a really hard job. And I wholly stand by that to a certain extent with anything in film. But I go, like, the curse and the blessing of my life is that I found it. And I've got a side hustle. I do a corporate job as a headhunter, which sounds like I'm an assassin, but I'm not, unfortunately. I just desk job recruitment. But you are cursed and blessed in the same moment, because you realize that you are able to make money and create and have fun in the most astounding way. But the nature of the industry is also that it's fickle, and it's not always there for you, and it's indifferent to you, and you'll have to work every day of your life to cling on with both hands, because everyone else realizes how good it is as well. And if you know you can do that as a job, it makes doing any other job quite hard. However, you work to find your compromise, you work to find your stability, and you find out what works for you. And if you love it enough, it will always come back to you. And I remember Scott Rogers right at the end of Batgirl, I had that sort of that young moment where I'm like, oh, maybe I'll never work again, as we all think at one point in our career. And he went, no, you will, you just have to keep going. And like, he goes, I know so many people in this career who like probably should have stopped and they didn't, and they just get the next job and they get the next job. And like, you will always find it if you just stick it out.
We talked to people previously about burnout, or mm-hmm. about the anxiety around not having enough work. And you're right, actually, sometimes if you quit, then it stops. Or mm-hmm. you can keep going. Maybe you can pause for sure and adapt and move. And the freelance kind of way, which is something we try and convey in the podcast, is there's not one route for everyone. Mm-hmm. You kind of have to adapt in life to all the different situations. So for you, you've managed to find this side hustle, which allows you to earn as well as doing your stunt work and pay for your training and that sort of thing. And other people have different ways of doing it, but you kind of just, as long as you keep moving forwards.
Everything costs in this life. Whatever path you choose is going to cost you. And I have many great friends who have abandoned their dreams to pursue money or a successful career, or have tried to fulfill other people's expectations of what they think a life well led is. And they'll be miserable in different ways to me. And I think it's really important to stress that, like, yeah, we get to live the dream. But like, the flip side of that coin is, like, I've worked for 8 months straight and like, the world is your oyster. And then I've worked for 8 days in a year. And they're both very real realities, regardless of how talented you are. And there is a cost to both. And the cost to this job is huge amounts of instability, often huge amounts of anxiety as a result. And you have to find your tribe and you have to find your way through. And I come from like a family of teachers, doctors, accountants, lawyers. My brother works in pensions. And then I'm here like, I want to work in movies. And like, you have to find your own you. So for me, stability is really key. So I know I've got friends who, you know, live with 5 other people in a house and they just do their training and they don't make a lot of money and they struggle through each month. And that's how they want to play this game. And they'll just ride it out till the next job. For me, I've gone like, I want a house. I want a mortgage. I'd like to be able to look after myself. And I have a huge amount of pressure from my family on like delivering the normal life around this nuts career. And so I have found a job that I'm so lucky to have, insofar as like, they let me run off and be a superhero for 5 months and then they give me a job as a consultant on the other side of it. And that's not to say, again, like I've still earned that, like you earn your stripes. And there was 3 years in my life where I worked a full-time office job. I took all my holidays to do stunts and acting. And then I ran out of holiday in my office job. So I would work weekends, and then I ran out of weekends, and I would wake up at 3 a.m. I would go and do a full day on set and I would wrap at 6. I'd be home by 7. I'd work till 10 or 11 at night. And then I'd go to bed and wake up at 3 a.m. and I'd do it all again. And like, that costs. And I've now, through that though, managed to earn a compromise. So I'm not saying it's easy by any sense of the word, but you can always find a way through. But you need to work out what costs you're willing to pay. And I still wanted to be able to stand with my friends and family and go like, yeah, I've got a house and I've got a car that sometimes works. Not at the moment, but we'll find out. And that mattered to me more than having lots of time to train, which means like I now work an office job when I'm not on a film set or working. I'll do an office job 3 or 4 days a week and I'll work a couple of half days and I will go and train 4 hours of gymnastics and then I'll come back and I'll do another hour or two of work and then I will go to trampolining in the evening and then I'll do it all again the next day. And every weekend I don't go on holiday, I don't see my friends, I don't see my family. Like, there's still costs. Like, this career will burn a lot of your life and you need to work out if it's worth it. And if it's not, like Emilia Clarke says, do something else. But if that fire is lit inside you, and we will know that, there's kind of no choice.
And I think you absolutely nailed it with choose your compromise, because it sounds silly to say, but the people who succeed at the things you want have been willing to sacrifice pieces themselves, things they could have done along the way to get there. And so you look at, okay, I want to achieve this, and you look at your life and you go, what are the parts of me or the activities I'd like to do that matter less than achieving this goal? Mm-hmm. And in the same way with your finances, a lot of people in the industry, when they're between jobs, will go and work in a coffee shop and they will go, oh, I'm failing. And like, no, what you're doing is you are paying your bills while you're building your network, while you're building your skills, so that you can keep working in it. And it's the path to that success, and it's a success that is a path you just have to keep walking week after week, month after month, year after year. It is a series of compromises, and it's you going, you know what, actually, I am going to take 2 months off so that I can spend my time with my loved ones. Or is you going, I'm okay missing that bachelor party because there is an amazing opportunity mm-hmm. to work with a stunt coordinator. And it's about you, each of us in the industry, going, what are the compromises that I'm prepared to make mm-hmm. for the life that I want, for the dreams that I have? And it's, everyone will have an opinion on that, but ultimately you have to be the one that goes, am I happy with those choices? If I am, do I want to keep making them? If I'm not, how do I want to change that?
I think people also, like everyone, I think everyone who's giving you advice by and large wants you to be happy. And they are giving you best advice to their knowledge that they are happy to live with. And it's their compromise that they're advising you to have. So it's a really interesting journey I've had with my family over the past, you know, 7 to 10 years of like, no one understands this job. And that's fine. And we've learned a way to communicate that and share passions. And the advice I was often given early on was advice around stability, because that's how they've lived their lives and formed that. So inherently, that's how I've also then structured my life. But it's also recognizing when someone gives you advice, they're trying to help with the knowledge they have, but they don't have the knowledge you have. And they're not the one who has to live with your life. And God, it's taken me many years to realize, but I've basically gone like, I need to live with my decisions. And I think a helpful thing I did was write myself a timeline with stunts, because you definitely have those days where you're like, God, what am I doing? This is just like horrific. I'm seeing the physio once a week who's popping my ribs back into place just so I can continue training, and I'm not even doing the job. And, you know, your bills are low and you're never seeing your friends and you're having to eat like nothing the whole time to try and double these actresses. And like, it's grim at times. And I go, okay, well, set yourself a long-term timeline. And like, I've just given myself like, okay, so in 5 years' time, you can reassess whether you want to do stunts. And are you happy spending the next 5 years giving this a shot? And that's not to say in 5 years' time, I'll go, that's the cutoff, I'm done. That I go, you can reevaluate then. And I've done the same with my stunt training. I've done the same with a lot of things in my life where I go like, at what point would you be willing to look back if you didn't have this job and go, yeah, it wasn't for me, or yeah, I gave it my best shot. And I go like, until you're willing to live a different life and look back and not feel resentment for the fact that you didn't do it, you need to keep going.
One of my absolute favorite quotes is, in life, we must choose our regrets.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an idea that if you make the right decisions, you prioritize the right things, you won't have to regret your life. Because people say, oh, when you're in a nursing home, what are you going to regret? And I think it's incomplete. I think you are always going to have a part of you that's like, fuck, I wish I spent more time with my kids. Or I wish I had, you know, I wish I had worked with that director who I've loved their films. And I wish I had explored that opportunity. And it's about working out what are the regrets that you're happy going, you know what, maybe I'd have preferred a different life, but I'm pretty happy with the decisions I've made.
Yeah, I entirely agree. And I think for me, what's so surprising is all the moments in your life that you think will be the defining moment of your life, like so rarely were. And like, I actually take, like, this whole career is so funny for me because this whole career arguably started when I decided to choose fencing instead of ballet. And that set me off to become an international athlete. And then off the back of that, I got into this industry. And like, you just look at that. And like, all of my going to drama school in Ireland comes from a recommendation from my grandparents who jokingly suggested I should apply there. And so you look back at your life and you go, God, that was a defining moment where like my entire life is based off this one like casual decision. And anytime I've been going like, this is the moment where I choose between two giant jobs or something, it's like, that's never the moment that matters. So I think like, it's also going like, yeah, you're going to regret things, but also appreciating that like, when you think you're making a big decision, you're probably not. And when you're deciding whether to get like a cup of tea or a cappuccino, that's probably the decision that's going to set your career off in a different direction.
You went to get that cappuccino, so you bumped into someone and they said there's a job coming up and
you never know. And like, I think I had a lovely friend gave me some advice when I was sort of trying to work out sort of how to structure my life for the next couple of years. And he went like, Lucy, why are you planning 10 years in advance? Because I was like, yeah, when I get this, that will lead to this, which means that I can proceed on this 10-year plan of steps. And he was like, you're not going to get through that 10-year plan. Like, something's going to come and change that. And he's like, you literally can't plan what you're doing next week. So why are you trying to plan 10 years in advance in like the world's most unstable career? And he's like, just own the fact that you are talented, you're putting the work in, and off the back of that, things will come that are worth it and that are right for you.
And do those well, as best you can.
And it's, people tend to think outcome oriented.
Mm-hmm.
So if it worked, it was a good decision. If it wasn't, it wasn't. But life is actually process oriented. So if you go to a casino, you pull your life savings on black and you win, everyone's like, oh, it was a great choice. You've doubled your money. It's like, but that was a moronic decision process.
Terrible choice.
Yeah. And in the same way, it's when you, particularly when you're building a career, particularly in something like stunts, where it's, you have to be so talented and so like, have so many different skill sets to protect yourself while you're doing it. You have to put all this time into training before you've gotten any paid work.
Yep.
And so you have to go through the kind of wilderness of, I'm not getting any positive affirmation in terms of professional credits or in terms of income coming in that I am going to be able to pull this off.
And then you get the positive affirmation by having like the world's most amazing year where you're like working, people are ringing you, phones off, you know, off the hook the whole time. You're doing these nuts stunts. You're like, oh, this is amazing. This is my career. And then like, I'm not joking. I worked 8 months in 22 and then I worked like for the most part of 23, I worked about 8 days. And maybe I shouldn't be admitting that. And then I was very luckily given an amazing break on Gladiator 2. But you're like, I was doing everything right. And then suddenly like, even though you have and you've been rewarded with those affirmations, the industry just goes, no, we're going to go on strike, or no, this isn't going to work for you. No, you're on the wrong guild. And like, you're powerless. And you then have to have the grit to go like, I just need to move my piece like one box forward on this game and just keep going. Or you go, actually, I've had my great run and I'm happy with it. I'm not ready for that. So I go, then you just move that piece forward and trust that you are talented enough and things will come along.
What is the best piece of advice you've ever gotten?
I've got two. One is from the great Hilary Wood, my acting teacher at school. And this was actually from her before I'd got into drama school. I went and did a summer course at the same drama school. And talking about silly life decisions, my interview, and I then interviewed to do the 3-year acting course, they went, why do you want to join? And I went, this woman, I want to work with this woman. She just said, it was actually about audition processes, but I think it's great for life in general because we all take ourselves way too seriously. And she was just like, darling, don't give a galloping fuck what anyone thinks. You just do you, sort of thing. And I will always just like remember that as just don't. Just walk in there. You own yourself. You own your experience. And like, if someone's trying to pull you down, you're probably doing something right. It's kind of how I operate. The more successful you are, the more enemies you generate. So I stand by that quite a lot of like, I'm a huge worrier. And so I try and have that in the back of my head of just like, no one really cares at the end of the day. And the other one is my mum. And actually this was in relation to my office job when I was having a hard time trying to manage the great tsunami that was my work-life balance, or work-work balance, I guess you could call it. And I was like, I'm just exhausted. Like, I don't have the energy to just bring anything positive. And she went, Lucy, 50% of your job is being bubbly and nice. Every day you walk in, half of your job is bringing that energy, bringing that smile, being bubbly, interested, interesting. And I've carried that through with me. And I think I said it earlier, like, you must always be the nicest, most hardworking, most energetic person in that room, because none of those are skill-based. None of those are talent-based. Everyone can do those three things. And I always remember that when I'm having a tough day. And she's just like, you just show up and you put a smile on your face. And like, it's that sort of fake it till you make it mentality. If you feel it in your body, you do feel better. And people react to you in a different way, and they do actually lift your mood. But I go, if you count 50% of your job as just being a decent, nice, energetic person, that's like half the battle won, ironically. But also that other 50% is where you do your whole job. And I think it just changes your approach to work and life.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with both of those sentiments. Like, I did a training once where they're talking about the three non-renewable resources you take from people. The first is time, and that one we all understand. You know, if you spend a day with someone, you can't do something else. The next was attention, and it was like, okay, yeah, that makes sense, because you've only got so much focus you can give. And the third one, which blew my mind, was like energy. It's like, in any given day, we only have so much ability to put up with people who are tired, annoyed, complaining. And when you're doing that, you are taking from people. And you're taking full time. And then when they go home with their kids, do they have the patience to deal with little Timmy knocking over the salad bowl or whatever? And in the reverse, if you can go to someone and be like, hey, how you doing? That's fantastic. I love what you did. You are bringing energy to people, and you are enabling them to have better days, not only on set, but also when they get to go home. And that is something that we're drawn to, people who can give us that energy.
And it costs. Yeah. And that's not to say, like, I go home and I just like lie on my bed and go, oh God, it was so hard to bring all that energy. But you actually, that's the job. And it does, it will pay you back dividends throughout your life. But I also go, like, everyone remembers me as like, oh, Lucy, the nice, bubbly, chatty, friendly person. And like, every now and then someone's like, oh God, she's so energetic. And you go like, okay, but that's probably because I'm pulling energy out where maybe you're not able to. But then I just go, if you can do it, you should. And if you can be humble, you should. And if you can be generous and kind and interested. And like, none of these things are new sentiments. And I think we just forget them. And it's like, my whole acting training was grounded on the fact that everyone else and everything is more interesting than you. And that's not to say that the drama school taught that, but that's what I took away from it. And I stand by that forever. I'm like, everyone has a story. Everyone's interesting. Everyone's got a love, a hate, a fear, a wish, a dream. And like, it's like, you will get the best out of life if you tap into that, or if you tell those stories, or if you give that back. And like, life is what you make it. And like, people kind of make life good. So it's remembering that.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, sounds silly to say, but I'm in a little bit awe.
Well, I'm in awe of you two. So.
Amazing. I think we are going to have to draw it to a close, even though we could probably talk about so many more things. We will put in our show notes a way for people to contact you, any resources that you want to share with us for aspiring stunt performers. Maybe people keep an eye out for your short films when they're up and going.
We're in final editing stages, so I'm about to send it to some good friends of mine who are like, again, the beauty of film, I've got directors and producers and people who you can go, hey, what do you think of this? And they can tear it to shreds, and then maybe one day it'll get out there.
Amazing. Thank you so much for coming on to
the podcast.
Thank you.